The soul craves, thirsts for a sense of harmony, a unified perspective to the parsha. There's nothing more disorienting, unnerving, when the parsha seems hobbled, diffused, all over the place. And if at first glance, a superficial read of the parsha seems disjointed, that's simply an invitation to dig deeper, to find that theme, that neshama of the parsha, which weaves all the passages together into splendid harmony. So let's begin here, Parshas Naso, by noting its seeming hobbled disparity to the superficial reader, and then reap the reward when we dig deeper and see how it really coalesces around a relevant, resonant theme. The parsha begins rather logically, following the precedent of last week's parsha. Parshas Bamidbar last week dealt with the establishment of the Jewish camp situated around the Mishkan. There was an inner ring of Levim, families from Levi, who were placed around various directions of the Mishkan, and then an outer ring of various Shvatim of Israelites, of Yisraelim, placed around the Mishkan. And each tribe and each family of Levi were not only situated in separate areas, but delegated with distinct tasks. In the case of the families of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, each one transports various parts of the Mishkan when the Jewish people are in transit. So our parsha begins by saying, count the individual Levite families, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, and designate to each family the part of the Mishkan which they are supposed to transport. And the parsha continues. Now that the Jewish camp has been set up, well, the impure individual, a fellow who's tamei, is actually sent away from this camp, this encampment which has been created, through an inner circle called Machane Levi, a Levite camp around the Mishkan, and then a Machane Yisrael, this Israelite camp. We have various camps now, and we could talk about which impure individuals are barred access to various camps. So the opening of the parsha seems to fit right in, continuing Parshas Bamidbar's focus on the camp and the various responsibilities which different Levite families have. But then seemingly from nowhere, our parsha goes in an entirely different direction. Our parsha talks about, next, the issue of restitution. How an individual who sinned and needs to do tshuva is supposed to confess, the mitzvah of vidui is in this week's parsha, and the way he's supposed to pay his restitution to the two individuals who he owes money to. Now, this restitution narrative seems right out of a Yom Kippur sort of liturgy. And its placement in our parsha dealing with the issue of the Levite family's responsibilities and the camp, is perplexing. Especially when we consider the focus and the theme of our Book of Bamidbar. Ramban notes that Sefer Bamidbar is largely not a Sefer of ritual and mitzvos, like the previous Sefer of Vayikra. Sefer Bamidbar is a storyline of the Jewish people in the desert. Any halachos, any ritualistic law appearing here must somehow relate to the storyline. So what is this issue of restitution, confession, admission? What is this halacha, straight out of the Yom Kippur liturgy, as we termed it, what does it have to do with the Bamidbar story of the division of the Jewish camp, the establishment of the Jewish camp, and the allocation of responsibilities to the Levite families? And then our parsha continues, by talking of how we must pay our gifts to the Kohen. It tells us that the individual Israelite may decide which Kohen he gives the gift to. But once the Kohen takes the gift, it's the Kohen's. Now, again, this law, how we give gifts to the Kohen, seems out of place here in Sefer Bamidbar. And then our parasha becomes juicier. Our parasha deals with the sota, the suspected adulteress, and everyone's ears perks up, domestic issues. This is the stuff that sells. This is the stuff which attracts attention. But again, it seems disjointed, the suspected adulteress, these laws. Out of place. What does it have to do with the larger Bamidbar narrative, the larger Nusso narrative? And then our parasha deals with the Nazir, the Nazirite, who makes vows to abstain from wine. And then our parasha deals with the Birchas Kohuna, the Birchas Kohanim, the blessings which you and I just received on Yantif, the Yivarechecha Hashem. What does that have to do with anything? And then our parasha concludes with the donations of the Nesiim. The Nesiim, the princes, gave donations to the Mishkan. And that is how our parasha concludes. So I think it's very apparent the seeming hobbled disjointedness of our parasha all over the place, from how we pay restitution payments to the suspected adulteress, the sota, to the donations of the princes. Where is this all going? But the parasha never disappoints us. We approach the parasha with a faith and a confidence that the parasha is going to itself is going to direct us. All we need to find is that framework, that structure within the parasha itself, how it aligns itself, how it patterns itself, and that will be our key to see it, to bring to light this great piece of artwork here called the parasha and how it comes together. And frequent attendees of this year are well aware of our bookend thesis, that when you want to discover the framework of our parasha, well, look at how it begins, how it ends, and study the symmetry. The bookend phenomenon is very apparent in Parshas Naso. It begins with Nasoas Rosh, raise the heads, count the heads of the Levite families who are going to receive various responsibilities of what they carry. And it ends with the Nesiim, the princes, who donate the wagons which the Levites in fact use to transport the Mishkan material. So here we have right in front of us, the parasha is beginning and ending with the issue of carrying. Whether the beginning of the parasha counting the individual Levites who are going to carry, or the parasha's end, the Nesiim, the princes, who are donating the wagons that are going to be used for that transport process of Mishkan material. Now, you might say this is a letdown. This is a parasha about so prosaic, so mundane a task, such as carrying. But again, when we dig deeper, we begin to sense the grand design up the divine author's sleeve. There's a powerful motif to carrying and the Levim carrying the items of the Mishkan. Carrying can connote to some a burden. I feel laden. I feel imposed upon. And that is a negative way to approach responsibilities and Avodas Hashem. If our parasha's theme is carrying, and the Levim's carrying as reflected by its bookends, then I'm going to suggest it's dealing with this whole issue of how we shoulder responsibilities and how we raise our mission, confidently aloft rather than buckling under the weight of a laden sense. And the clue is, again, when we restudy the bookends, both the parsha's beginning, the counting of the Levite families who are going to carry Mishkan material, and the end, the Nesiim, the princes who donate the wagons for the transport. Because you will notice in both cases, the term carrying, Nesiyah, is used not in a demeaning, burden-laden context, but in an elevating context. In the beginning of the parasha, the Levim who are going to carry the Mishkan, about them the Torah says, Naso es rosh, lift their heads up when you count them for this responsibility. Each Levite head is lifted proudly as he in turn assumes the responsibility of lifting. And then likewise in the end of the parsha, the princes who donate the transportation wagons for this carrying are called Nisiim, the lifted ones. Because in Yiddishkeit, responsibilities ennoble us. Avodas Hashem ennobles us, empowers us. It is a privilege to serve Hashem and to assume, and for each of us to assume our individual responsibilities. We feel, as the Nesiim did, elevated. We feel, as the Levim did, Naso es rosh, their heads lifted up. The powerful usage of this term, Naso, Nesiim, lifted up, in the context of a responsibility of carrying is very, very powerful. When one assumes responsibility of Avodas Hashem with a sense of positivity, with a sense of a privilege, then they don't feel laden upon, they in turn feel lifted. And this theme and symbolism of the lifting begins to open up some of the enigmas of our parsha we touched on before. For example, we asked why our parsha deals with the priestly blessing, the Birchas Kohanim. Well, what is the term used for the Birchas Kohanim, the duchening? Nisiyas kapayim, lifting the palms. You hear that word, lifting, reappearing, but moreover, you hear the great motif here of how to approach a responsibility in Judaism. When the Kohanim are lifting up their palms, holding their palms aloft, do they feel burdened by holding their arms up? Certainly not. They have a princely, priestly sense of, I am a carrier of the blessing here. I have what to offer the Jewish people here. So I am holding my arms high, not with a sense of burdensomeness, but quite the contrary, with a sense of, I am proud. I possess the blessing. I possess the virtue to share with the people. And I am elevated in executing and fulfilling this responsibility. And this is the way we Jews, whether we are Kohanim, whether we are Levim, whether we are bakers or candlestick makers, this is how we approach, each of us, our individual missions in Avodas Hashem. And this is so important. We all know individuals at times of great talent and potential who suffer burnout, who feel, as we called it, laden by their burdens, rather than seeing their responsibilities as elevated privileges. In all of life, we want to experience our responsibilities with positivity, but certainly in Avodas Hashem, in our religious life, nothing can be more precious. The imperative could not be greater than here to feel elevated rather than chalila demeaned, to feel lifted up rather than burdened down by our naso, not only parshas naso, but naso motif as we carry our mission aloft. Now, as we consider this phenomena and seek to guard ourselves against the burnout issue, one issue which comes to mind, certainly in an organizational setting, is when people feel that they are taken advantage of, their space, their place is not being respected. Say they feel their boss is shoving responsibilities down their throat and not recognizing their needs as an individual, their space, their time, their personal time, their personal space, their personal rights. This is a common issue we hear. And one which is true in Jewish institutions as well, I can attest from inside. As with every organization, to cultivate a sense of harmony, that each individual feels complete and completed in participation, it only works when each of our own individuality, space, zone is respected. Well, this very issue of ensuring that each individual's rights are guarded, because that is indispensable to ensuring that they will fulfill their responsibilities with positivity, opens up yet another enigma in our parsha. We mentioned before that one of the laws in our parsha relates to how the Israelite gives his gift to the Kohen. We all have to give various gifts to the Kohen, from our grain, from our sheep. Listen with a sensitive ear to how the Torah describes a healthy relationship between the Yisrael and the Kohen when the Yisrael gives the Kohen the gift from his grain, from his sheep. It says as follows. V'chol truma, all gifts, l'chol chadshei b'nei Yisrael, asher yakrivu l'kohen, a gift given to the Kohen, lo yieh, is actually his, the Yisrael's. Explain the sages, the Yisrael has a right here when he gives the gift. As much as the Kohen is going to receive the gift, he cannot forcefully take it from the Yisrael. The Yisrael could determine which Kohen do I want to give the gift to. So lo yihyeh, it is his. It is his right, the Yisrael, to determine which Kohen receives the gift. The next pasuk continues, Isha asher yitein la kohen lo yiyah, but in turn, when the Kohen accepts the gift, now it belongs to the Kohen. You hear the echo, lo yiyah, it is his, the Yisrael's, to determine which Kohen he gives the gift to. But in turn, lo yiyah, it is his, the Kohen's. Once it is given to him, it's the Kohen's for good, and the Yisrael may not take the gift back. This mutual respect. The Kohen must respect lo yihyeh. It is his right, the Yisrael, to determine which Kohen he gives the gift to. And in the turn, the Yisrael respects equally. Lo yihyeh. It is his. It is the Kohen's gift once it's given to the Kohen. And there's no second guessing once it's given. Lo yihyeh. Lo yihyeh is more than a particular halacha, but bespeaks this healthy functioning of relationship, this healthy organizational environment in Judaism. The Kohen, the Yisrael, each one is going to be successful and come together as a group, so long as they each respect what is due the other, the legal rights due the other, lo yihia, lo yihia. And that is why this passage appears in Naso and enriches the great theme here of how to shoulder our responsibilities in an ennobling way rather than in a burdensome, laden way. Only gonna work when we each feel that our positions and our rights are respected rather than feeling taken advantage of. And again, we all know Klei Kodesh, people who are serving the Tzibor, who can feel taken advantage of. And that's a very, very sad thing when you see talented Klei Kodesh, Rabbanim, Mechankim, educators. Very sad when you see that. And there's a burnout there. They're humans too. And we have to respect that. Each of our contributions are just projected with a sense of health when the individual feels that they are respected and their space and their position in the organization is respected. It's a powerful phenomena to see that when an individual feels respected, they give not 100%, they give 120%. And perhaps nowhere is this more evident than in marriage. Marriage demands a lot of both spouses. And for marriage to be fulfilling and to work, well, we each ought to give 110%. But what about the burnout phenomena? Well, when it works, the individual who's giving that 110%, be it the husband, be it the wife, this is love. This is what I'm motivated to do. I don't feel taken advantage of. Why? Because my spouse respects me. My spouse respects my needs. I've actually told this frequently to my students in the Kollel. When they ask me Shalom Bayis advice, they've asked me to give Shiurim on Shalom Bayis. I said, I am going to wrap this up very succinctly for you. Take her needs seriously and treat her like a queen. You'll be paid back in spades. I could attest to this from personal life experience. If you treat her like a queen and whatever her few needs, creature comforts are, whatever they are, understand them, don't understand them, but respect them and provide for the most self-centered reason. Forget altruism. You will be paid back in spades. Chalila, the alternative, an individual feels burdened by family and their spouse. That is not a place to be. Well, this too, I would suggest, is reflected in our parsha by the Sota narrative. We asked, why is the Sota narrative dealt with in our parsha? The issue of infidelity, betrayal. What does that have to do with the carrying of the Levium? But now we're beginning to see. The carrying of the Levium is symbolic of the much larger issue of people, individuals, shouldering their responsibilities with pride, with a sense of fulfillment, rather than with a sense of resentment. Well, I would suggest, in this context, the Torah is having us think about the Sota and the unfortunate circumstance of betrayal and infidelity. What provokes a wife to do this? Now, of course, there can be all sorts of explanations. There's not one explanation. But so often, the issue at hand is she doesn't feel fulfilled in her relationship as Azer Kenegdo. She feels burdened. Marriage has become the execution of responsibilities. That's not exciting. That's not fulfilling. Wedlock literally feels like a lock. deadening, locking into place. And might that point to the fact that she doesn't feel that her needs, her space, her creature comforts are being provided for? Whatever the dynamics per se are in this marriage, and no two marriages are alike, but so often, otherwise good people can find themselves in this themselves in these unthinkable circumstances. And who would imagine? I will tell you, I've never been to a chasana where the chasana and kala under the chuppah, from what I could see, did not seem excited, did not have that glimmer in their eye of two doves. I look for it, and I see it every time. And we all know there are marriages and there are marriages in terms of how they pan out. Yeah? So I'm going to suggest there's a beautiful aesthetic here in the Torah weaving in the sota phenomena, the negative picture of the sota, the gloomy picture, none of us want to be there, into this whole parsha about responsibilities, not to feel burdened, but to feel elevated by responsibilities, because in the end, so much of marriage is actually executing responsibilities. From the inception of marriage, Jewishly speaking, the transaction, if we can call it that, largely consists of commitments on both sides. And yet, for those of us who are thriving in it, somehow within the fulfillment of those responsibilities comes all the magic, all the fulfillment. It is in the responsibilities, if we feel elevated, nasoas rosh, and not burdened, laden, shoved down by them. And I'm going to suggest that this new insight of ours to why the sota appears in Parshas Naso actually lies in a midrashic teaching. The sages in the Medrash cited by Rashi notice the juxtaposition of the sota narrative immediately following the narrative we discussed before of giving gifts to the Kohen. The Yisrael gives the gifts to the Kohen and ultimately recognizes now it's the Kohen. Now it's the Kohen's gift. Well, comment the sages with a word of caution. One who does not give the Kohen his due might end up in the Beis HaMikdash needing the service of the Kohen because his wife is a sota. The sota process, of course, is conducted by the Kohen. So there is as though this wagging finger in the Medrash connecting these two passages. You don't give the Kohen his due, you might need him at the end of the day if your wife is a sota. Now, on the surface, we feel a certain heartwarming sense of mida k'neged mida. Ha ha! The fellow disparaged the Kohen, didn't give the Kohen his due. He needed the Kohen. But something still remains incomplete about this Medrash. What is the connection? What is the direct correlation between denying the gifts to the Kohen and one's wife becoming a sota? What is the meaning here? But you and I are beginning to understand tonight the issue of the Yisrael respecting the Kohen's rights and vice versa, and the issue of husbands and wives respecting each other's rights and fulfilling each other's rights are very related. It's one underlying Parshas Naso dynamic. Sense of harmony, sense of health. Relationships between Yisrael and Kohen, between parts of the Jewish community, relationships between husband and wife are only going to work when on all levels there's a sense of respect for the individual, a sense of partnership and reciprocity here. But when one is living in given relationships in their life, without the sense of harmony, without the sense of partnership, They are cheating the Kohen and not giving the Kohen his due. Well, potentially the same sense of hobbled imbalance can occur even in more intimate relationships. It takes a good friend to make a good spouse. And certainly our Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, how we interact with our friends, with other members of the community, is certainly a good starting point to how we are going to interact with that most cherished friend, Reyim Ahuvim, spouses. And in all of these relationships, Parshas Naso is ringing resonant and clear. We want to ensure that our partners do not feel burdened by their responsibilities, but feel elevated, respected. And as we said, when this happens, they will pay us back in spades. That Kohen or Clay Kodesh, if he's respected, he's provided for financially, whether the Kohen his gifts, whether the rabbi's salary, his needs, his rights are provided for. He's not going to take his responsibilities as a 9-to-5 jobs. Weekly Kodesh don't do that. He's going to pay back the Yisrael in spades. And the same thing is true about a husband and a wife. Respected, provided for, barring mental issues, relationship, snags, but per se, it's amazing. It's really amazing when an individual feels respected and provided for, just this natural motivation they have to give their all. I think of how Rav Kook would sign his letters. Rav Kook would sign his letters, Eved La'am Hashem. Avram Yitzchak Kook, Eved La'am Hashem. I am Avram Yitzchak Kook, here to serve his people. Now, Rav Kook was a princely individual. He even studied pictures of him. He's an aristocrat. He's a prince. He did not feel burdened and hobbled when he wrote Avram Yitzchak Kook, who shepherds his people. He did not feel burdened by his responsibilities. He felt elevated by them. He was, in fact, a Kohen. And when an individual is elevated, they give their all. And this is true in all relationships, as we're saying, whether Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, marriage, and it's no less true in our relationship with Hashem. When we Jews feel fulfilled by our avodah, feel elevated by our avodah, rather than burdened by this legislator on high who's saying, do this, don't do that. Well, it's a game changer. The same mitzvos, simple truth, it's a game changer. This added layer, approaching our responsibilities to Hashem, just as we approach our responsibilities to our friends, to our spouses, we will see is borne out by yet another textual pattern in our parsha. Because you will notice, when you study the restitution narrative in our parsha, as we discussed, the Torah deals with an individual who needs to make a restitution. He did wrong and he needs to admit, confess, say vidui. The Torah describes him, limol mal b'Hashem, as having betrayed Hashem. Well, that is the very same terminology which appears in the narrative which follows in our parsha, the Sota narrative, umalo v'mal, she rebels against him. The Torah is describing a sense of betrayal when man betrays God or when wife betrays husband. What is this meta theme of betrayal, rebellion, as it's playing out? Betrayal, rebellion, is the sense when an individual feels wronged by the so-perceived task-giver in their life. You are imposing upon me, whether the wife in this case towards the husband, whether the Jew towards Hashem, you are imposing upon me, so I will snub you. I will assert my own presence. Umalo v'amal, mal mal b'Hashem. The echo terminology in our parasha comes together in terms of this negative precedent of when an individual feels a need to rebel, weaved into the larger dynamic of Parashas Naso. The Torah is directing us to understand, where does this rebellion come from? This, what drives an otherwise good individual, not simply to sin, but to snub God, to rebel against God? Well, it's the same thing which drove the Sota wife to snub her husband. Why did a otherwise good, originally loving wife do that? Well, so often it comes from this sense of an unhealthy perception of what nusso, what burdens are, what responsibilities are, that they are in fact burdens. The game changer is this healthy sense when we feel respected, when we feel elevated by the responsibilities, and then all of the magic, all of the fulfillment, be it in marriage between husband and wife, be it in the great divine marriage between us and Hashem, this is the game changer. I would suggest there is one final dimension to this Parshas Naso theme about how we handle responsibilities, how we feel elevated by responsibilities rather than feeling demeaned, exploited, taken advantage of. Thus far, we studied this phenomena and traced it in our parasha on two levels. Bein Anam L'Makam, between man and God, and Bein Anam L'Chaveiro, between man and friend, man and spouse. But we know in the writings of Maharal, most famously, there is a third relationship. Along with Bein Anam L'Makam, between man and God, and Bein Anam L'Chaveiro, between man and friend, there is what Maharal terms Bein Adam L'Atzmo, between man and himself or herself. There is a relationship to self. There is a sense of providing for oneself, recognizing one's own needs, spiritually, physically, materially, and ensuring they're met, and bringing out the best self. One cannot be a good caregiver towards others, and certainly not a good Eved HaShem if they are not caring for self, being out on the Atzma. Well, I would suggest in the Atzmo too, when one deals with themselves, and sometimes we can find the hardest person to live with ourselves, towards self, there must be this healthy approach to responsibility. For example, when one has a personal shortcoming, take the common example, say in the area of health, hygiene, dieting, to pick an innocuous, not religious per se example. It's amazing the comments I've heard people say. I hate myself. I feel it. And I want to say, you're talking about yourself here. Words matter. Words matter. When approaching your own personal needs, you feel negative about yourself. Would you speak that way to your kid? Would you speak that way to your wife when dealing with their issues and helping them? Certainly you ought not speak that way about yourself. Towards self too, there must be a sense of, I am shepherding myself in a positive, elevating, not demeaning way. And this, I would suggest, is a deeper meaning to the restitution narrative in our parasha when it says the individual ultimately admits, confesses, rises to the plate of accepting responsibility for what they did. very hard to do that and admit shortcoming and say, Vidoy, fulfill the mitzvah in our parsha. Oh, it so hurts. I was wrong. We all know that in relationship. The three words, I love you, the easy. It feels great to say them. But I was wrong. Oh, boy. But when an individual comes forward and has the guts and the takes responsibility and says Vidoy, admits, assumes responsibility for themselves and their shortcomings, well, there's a certain rewarding sense of I am handling myself, shortcomings and all, in a wholesome way, in a life-affirming way, which is allowing me to say Vidoy here. And this same phenomena, I would suggest, is played out in the final passage in our parasha we have hitherto dealt with, and that is the nazir, the individual who decides, I need to abstain from wine. I have various temptations which are out of balance. I have addictions. We all have those areas of life where we need to take personal responsibility and discipline ourselves. Well, the Torah sees this individual in the noblest light. It calls him a nazir. The same term is used for a prince. He is a prince of a man when he recognizes his own shortcomings and takes unclassical measures, which he or she recognized they need to do in their personal life. It's really much like the person who is making amends, making a restitution, and saying vidui, as we said before. When we assume responsibility for self, we grab the bull by the horns and say, I know what my shortcomings are, I'm going to deal with this, and as we put it, a life-affirming way, in a way which leaves me nuzzier, as a prince, rather than a pauper, or feeling like the dregs. This phenomena is no less a healthy carrying of responsibilities, nusso, rather than feeling burdened, laden, buckled under heavy baggage. And we could suggest that this shiur tonight, where we seem to have connected dots in hitherto unforeseen ways, we have gone from the Nusso Es Rosh in the beginning of the parasha, lifting up the head of the Levi, that sense of lifting the head high, all the way down here to the Nazir, who feels lifted and elevated as he reigns in his life and abstains from that which he's unable to control. Well, a powerful textual echo now resonates. You will notice in the Nazir passage, the term Rosh, head, keeps on reappearing in our parasha. Not only regarding Sa'ar Rosho, the hair on the Nazir's head, which he needs to grow, which he must grow long, but in other terminologies such as Kinezer Elokav al Rosho, the crown of Hashem is upon his head, his Rosh. The Kidash Es Rosho, he sanctifies his head. If God forbid he becomes impure, Vitime Rosh Nizro, it's his head which has become impure. He's undermined that princely head. This term, Rosh, the head of the Nazir, the head of the Nazir, the head of the Nazir, one of those red threads laced throughout the passage, or as we've called it in the past, fluorescent neon color light phrases. What does it do? What is it all about? Well, I suggest it is intended to echo of the term Rosh in the beginning of the parasha. Naso es Rosh. Lift the Levite's head high when you count him and delegate responsibility to him. Tell the Levite, you are not an indentured servant to the people when you carry. No, lift your head high. Well, no less the Nazir, who is told about his head, wear the crown upon your head, sanctify your head, hold your head high. The echo of the beginning of the parasha is a very, very powerful one. We hold our head high as we assume responsibilities, including responsibilities for our own needs and limitations as we grow in this great journey called life. Taking a step back and looking at the parasha and the creative fashion in which we developed it this evening as a whole, and how the great Nusso carrying motif, which we traced from our bookends and beyond, how we carry and shoulder responsibilities, don't feel laden upon, but feel elevated. How enriching it will now be to tie the final bow, that satin bow, where we will see that in fact the sages of old have actually already articulated this idea that the carrying of the Levites in our parsha is supposed to reflect how we shoulder responsibilities in a princely fashion, ennobling fashion, rather than a demeaning fashion. Well, we have a well-known teaching in the Gemara regarding the holiest of all vessels held by the Levim, the Aron. And we are told when the Levites carried the Aron, Aron nosei esnosav, the Aron miraculously carried its holders. When the Levim from Kahas held the Aron, they actually felt the Aron was holding them. Well, beyond simply a miracle of times of old, when they held that heavy cedar wood of the Aron, they felt lifted. Beyond simply a miracle, the symbolism, the message is powerful. When we perform our Avodas HaKodesh and hold our Aron aloft, it can actually feel weightless. We can actually, in turn, feel held up ourselves. For everything I am doing for the mitzvah, how much the mitzvah is doing for me. For everything I am giving my wife and my children, how much this experience is, in turn, giving me. For everything I am doing for Hashem when I daven, how much actually the davening is doing to me. Well, now we're beginning to understand that this midrashic teaching regarding the Aron was not uttered in isolation, but actually magnificently captures the entire message of Parshas Nusso, the parsha about how the Levim shoulder their burdens, supposed burdens, and how in turn a Jew shoulders responsibilities, is so magnificently captured by how the holiest of all of the Levim carried the holiest of all vessels and were in turn held up themselves. Satin bow to our parsha indeed. We can own this midrashic teaching in the Gemara now in fact as our own, our entire development in our parsha, encapsulated in the teaching of the sages as old. And in conclusion, my friends, the meta theme and message we have traced pervasively throughout Parshas Nusso could not be more relevant. We all are wearing many hats, family man or woman, employer, employee, Oved Hashem, shul member, community member. The game changer is, are we laden by these responsibilities or elevated by them? So much of this has to do with our attitude. So much of this has to do with the way those we are engaged with are treating us and how we decide to be treated by them. all of this which we study tonight in Parshas Naso. I would suggest, when contemplating new responsibilities and even new mitzvahs in life, it is healthy to ask oneself the question, how am I feeling about this mitzvah, this responsibility as presented to me right now? Do I feel elevated by it? Do I feel, it's just a very simple, a certain, we all feel it in the core of our neshama. Do I feel alive by this? As much as it might be demanding a significant investiture of time, emotion, finance, whatever it might be, or do I have that elated sense about it? That's a very important question to think about and consider when we assume that responsibility. Because we all want to feel elevated by our mitzvos. This is the most precious area of our life. How sad to approach our mitzvah life, our family life, all these most precious areas, with anything but the most fulfilled, elevated sense. So Parshas Naso, with all of its multiple mitzvahs, with all of its variety of dimensions, actually comes together cohesively with a most relevant, resonant theme, which it has been a delight to develop together and to bring to light. Thank you all very much.
Yeah.
Baruch Tiyah. Any very questions?
Very uplifting. And you know, it's a very interesting thing. It's an appeal to being truly adult, because a hallmark of adultness, particularly in relationship, is that the adult says, I don't need you, but I want you. And the wanting is that which then, of course, elevates us. That is what it instills us with the simcha. Yeah. And when you said before that you have never seen a couple